Let's begin with college essays. And joining us live is Priyanka Shingala of letstalkcollege.org. Priyanka, great to have you back on the show. Let's talk essays, the dreaded essays for some kids, right?
Right.
Yeah, I know my three were not. Well, actually, one of mine was a writer and didn't really have to struggle with it too much. But is it college essay season? When do the kids really need to begin to work on them?
Okay, well, the best time to work on them would have been the summer between junior and senior year. And the second best time is now because we have deadlines. A lot of deadlines are October 15th, January 1st, November 1st, November 15th, and then January 1st, January 15th. So now's a good time to start.
Okay, so November 1st, that's one certainly if people are listening, they can, hunker down with their kids and perhaps help. And we'll get to that about how much parents should actually help with the process. All right. So but I think we talked about this last time. Yeah, it's better to do it in the summer before you have all these other pressures of school and the college application and this and that.
Exactly.
How long, Priyanka, does a student really need to give themselves like days or weeks or months to write a college essay?
Well, Bridget, that one actually you referred to just a bit earlier, which is when you said one of your children had a really easy time because she was a great writer. But the thing is, it really depends on your writing skills, because some students, even as early as like last week, we sat down for 5 hours across 2 days or something, and we hammered out the essay. But then for other students, it can take about a month or 2 months because we just can't nail it down. So it really, you have to take a teenager's writing abilities into account when you're thinking, hey, can I really do this last minute? Or am I giving myself the best shot I can by starting early?
Right, Priyanka. And I guess also it would depend a lot on what experiences your child has had. In other words, if something just naturally leaps to mind, I know, again, in the case of my daughter, my oldest, and they're all fine writers, don't want to upset anybody. But in her case, something really struck her immediately. I think before she even read the prompt, she wanted to write about my mom and, the experience growing up with her living in our home. And it was sort of a little bit of a layup. She knew what she wanted to write about and she felt it. But I think for a lot of kids, they have a lot of trouble finding something. So tell us a little bit, if you would, about the essay prompts and how that can work with a child coming up with a good topic.
Okay, so there are 7 essay prompts that students can choose from, and it doesn't matter which one you pick, because that's one topic that always comes up, which is, oh, do colleges prefer one over the other? No. So you write the one that you feel you can tell the best story for. And of the 7, one is just a free-for-all, share an essay on a topic of your own choice. But the other ones, they talk about background, identity, interest, or talent you enjoy, or obstacles you might have encountered that you've learned from, or a time you questioned or challenged a belief, or maybe someone did something that made you really happy, and what is it about that that made you grateful and motivated you, or a period of personal growth. And the other one is just the final one is, what is something you love doing so much you lose all track of time? So there's a variety that students can talk about. And one of the reasons I think most students struggle with their topics is because we haven't written about ourselves before. We've written about the English, we've written about the history, but we've never been our main topic. But every student has something to share. That's my main thing I tell every time I meet a student. The first meetings is just, it doesn't matter that it's not obvious. It doesn't matter if you haven't been abroad to a volunteering trip or you don't feel you have anything to share. Just by the fact that you've lived your 17 years of life, you have something to share. There is a story in you, or multiple stories in you. We just have to tease them out.
That's so important. And I think what happens, here in the Northeast, if you live in a somewhat affluent part of Connecticut, you might say, you know, some kids might say, gee, I don't have not a hard luck story, but I don't have a story of overcoming adversity. I don't have a story like that to tell. What in the world can I tell about myself as this kid who, you know, did sports, did okay in school, had some nice friends? How can I make that compelling? How do you tease it? How do you tease a compelling story out of a student?
Okay. So first thing to think about, where did you grow? Where did you become uncomfortable or just challenge yourself? Now, I've had students who right now we just wrote an essay about her theater. She's in theater. And that's not exactly, again, an adversity or anything. But you know what? She was growing. She had to learn communication. She is working with 50 other students right there. There are multiple departments to go through to pull one show together. So you grew. You couldn't just say whatever you wanted to everyone and basically expect them to do it. You had to learn effective communication. You had to learn effective management. That all still happened. Or I have students who are in sports. Once again, you had to learn to work with your team. You had to learn discipline. I imagine most students who are in sports are not simply skipping their practices or showing up whenever they feel like it. So again, there's a team dynamic. There's a dependency. You're part of a whole. That's a story there. I've had other students who've, and the thing is, it's not about, I really want to emphasize this. It's not about coming up with this fascinating story to share. A lot of these stories are what are seemingly mundane. Students who worked at the ice cream shop, and then they're like, but that sounds so boring. And I said, okay, great. Did you ever have rush hour? And obviously they have. Okay, great. Did you mess up everyone's order? No. Okay. Did you get yelled at by an angry customer at any point? Yes. Great. What did you do then? Right? So an obstacle doesn't have to be this huge impact or high impact or high sort of blowback type activity. It can just be the skills that you've been pulling together as you've gotten older.
Right. And you know what, Priyanka, I feel like sometimes I remember when mine were writing theirs, I think the middle school and high school experience of writing tends to lean toward more of, I don't know if this is the way you would classify it, but expository. In other words, you know, you write a story like this happened, then this happened, then this happened. And then at the end, it's like, so back to the beginning, you know, it seems almost like a format. And the good essays, I think, that you read, and I cheated and looked a little bit at your website, is to bring the story to life. And to your point about kids not being used to writing about themselves, but bring it to life and use those details. That's what I always hammered my kids on. Like, give me an interesting detail. Like, bring this to life for me.
Right. And you know what? It's such a... It's the show versus tell thing, which is how we say it in all writing, which it's don't tell us, show us. So I'll give you an example. If I had a student whose intro started with, I struggled to speak in public. I was once given the opportunity to give a short 1 to 2 minute speech at my high school. It was scary. I was a nervous wreck. But I realized that if I practiced long enough, I would be okay. So that's one example. Now let's take it and flip it. My palms were sweating as I stepped up to the podium. My heart pounded in my chest and my voice trembled as I began to speak. I forced myself to take a deep breath and focus on my notes. Then I spoke. So which one grabs you more that makes you want to know, hey, let me keep reading?
Right, exactly. Or as I would tell my children, you know, having been a news writer for many, many years, you have to grab people by the throat. Because there are a lot of other things they could be reading in these college admissions people. I mean, my goodness, you know, just the amount of stories that they have to read. We, this half hour, are all about college essays. And so many of you probably have children who are trying to get into college right about now, trying to tackle that college essay. One of the deadlines, November 1st. And lucky enough to have Priyanka Shingala with us. She is with letstalkcollege.org. By the way, I should point out, if you want to go to the website, it's fantastic. It can really help you, you know, take a look and absorb all of these things that we're talking about. It's Let's Talk College without the apostrophe .org, right, Priyanka? Did I get the website? Okay, good.
Yes, thank you.
Okay. Punctuation is important, right? When it comes to essays, let's talk a little bit about some of the common mistakes that children make when they're or young adults, I should say, when they are writing essays. And I would think, I mean, this is kind of a no-brainer, but you need to be truthful, right? I mean, the college admissions people, again, they have to be somewhat jaded, and they probably have a good you-know-what detector.
Agreed, especially when you're going through thousands of essays. And it's usually what I tell students who feel like they don't have anything to say, so they want to stretch their stories a little more to cover something fascinating. I usually say the same thing, which is, imagine if an eighth grader was trying to trick you. Considering you're in 11th grade right now, do you think you'd catch them? Chances are, yes. So similarly, your audience has been going through thousands of essays. They know the filters. They know, okay, this is maybe a little stretched, or they know that, okay, this is not how a 17-year-old writes. Maybe this is someone older who might have written it. But yes, they will know.
Right. And about someone older helping, mm-hmm. right? I mean, how much as a parent, I really sort of had to sit on my hands and not take the old red pencil out of mm-hmm. storage and go through it and say, no, this needs to, you know, but just ask questions like, well, tell me what was remarkable about, you know, as you say, like working in the ice cream shop or whatever.
Right.
How much can a parent get involved? What is being helpful as a parent, and what is being too much of a hardcore editor?
Okay. And this has happened before. So I would say you're being helpful as a parent when you are, one, having your teenager focus on the one topic and deep diving in. And number two, ensuring that there are no grammatical errors, that the story comes across as clearly as possible, and the values that your teenager holds come across as clearly as possible. What is not helpful is when you go in and this is a common mistake parents make, which is they say, oh, you haven't included enough, and the final product ends up being a wordy version of your resume. That's a common topic because parents feel, you know, we want to talk about this topic, but also this, but this is also fascinating about you as my teenager, as my kid. I want you to, you know, I want them to know how cool you are. So well-intended, but there's a separate section for your resume. There's a separate section for your activity section. The admissions officers will see that. So you have to stick to one theme. The other part is, don't rewrite the essays in that the grammatical, it's going to make you cringe. Some of the writing will make you somewhat cringe because they're 17-year-olds. Their writing skills are not developed. And it's something I have to remind myself as well when I'm helping them out is, okay, remember, yes, do I know a better way or a different way to write this? Yes, I do. But is this grammatically correct? It is. Does it get the point across? It does. Is it too wordy? Okay, if it is, then that's where I have to step in. So you have to know, you have to balance the grammar and storytelling versus, okay, it doesn't sound formal enough, or it doesn't sound proper enough, or it doesn't include enough content.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I think that's really important, you know, especially in this age of texting, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, you know, a lot of young people are used to communicating, you know, all lowercase, no punctuation, et cetera, et cetera. Yeah. Don't get me going. I don't know if you tackle this at all on your website, but I have to ask, what about AI? Have you found that some kids are turning to that to help them churn out a college essay?
Yes, I have. Fortunately, it hasn't been my students because I basically comment on everything. But I have had students saying that, oh, my classmates are using this, and it's just not fair how fast they're getting work done, or I'm spending hours trying to finesse my essay, and yet we're applying to the same university. So how is it fair that we're applying to this really competitive university and we both have these essays? But the thing is, with AI, there are certain patterns. If you put in enough in AI, you will notice that all the content that's chugged out, there's a writing pattern to it. So if you fully have AI essay, an admissions officer is going to know, because their writing syntax is very, it repeats. There's some word choices that constantly repeat. There's a tone thing that does repeat. Because I experimented this for my blog post just to say, okay, AI is here. I need to start understanding what it is. Let me play with this. But yes, there are students who try to use AI, and it unfortunately is hard to monitor, and universities are working on figuring out how exactly to filter through that. But if you're using AI and your entire essay is AI, it's very, very obvious.
Yeah. Yeah. That's good to know. And I just really, you know, this is your chance to tell the college who you are. Right.
Right.
You know, so, I mean, to even think about using AI would be, you know, not just wrong, but ironic. I mean, it's just, you know, it's just like, don't do it.
In some ways, you're destroying your self-confidence when you do that. Because if you think about it, if you genuinely sit down and think about what is a college essay supposed to do, well, it's the first chance you get to add a little personality, a little flair, and your quirks to your entire application. Because other than that, they have your numbers. But numbers repeat. GPAs repeat. SAT, ACT scores repeat. There's a cap on what's a perfect score. You're not going to somehow break that. Then your activities, they're also going to repeat because there's only so much that's available, particularly if they're all minors. You can't really even volunteer at animal shelters and interact with the animals. You're either cleaning, right? So there's limitations based on age, and there's limitations just based on what's available in the community. Mm-hmm. So now, how do you differentiate yourself? How do you share your quirks, right? Oh, I have a student who loves who sells sneakers, like sneaker reselling. He had to figure out the whole business model for it, but he taught himself. That was not anywhere else in his application. That hard work he had to put in was not anywhere else in the application. Students who are in theater had to learn to get over the frustrations of working. That's not anywhere else in the application. So you are cool just by yourself.
Right.
But you have to figure out how you have to give yourself a genuine shot. You can't say I'm not good enough because you are.
Right. Yeah. And really talk about that thing. Well, I felt that with mine, it was important. In other words, if they were going for a specific major and a specific program, mm-hmm. like mm-hmm. And talk about an interest related to that, because that's why you want to go to that college, right?
Mm-hmm.
My fashion major daughter wound up writing an essay about being a little girl and playing with paper dolls and loving to dress them. And I thought that was, you know, that was just great. It was like, yeah, I'm genuinely interested in your major.
Mm-hmm.
And this
mm-hmm.
is, you know, this is my story.
And I think in there, I'll add in, it's important to balance you and your story with just talking about the university. Because
right.
a common mistake that happens with that approach is you're almost so busy flattering the university and everything it has to offer that you kind of forget that it's about you and how your interest sparked in the first place. What is it that makes you curious about it? And deep dive a little bit more into why you enjoy it. You can't, for example, if you're going into anthropology, you can't simply say, I love learning about different cultures and the people and traveling. You don't want to say that. Instead,
right.
be a little more specific. So say, you know, it's interesting how in Japan, the culture has a sense of peace, and yet they have a balance between their samurai and ninja
okay.
background. But somehow also there is a Buddhism aspect, right? So now
right.
you're getting, now
right.
a reader can get it.
Yeah. Priyanka, great advice as always. We thank you so much, Priyanka Shingala. Let's Talk College. Hope to talk it again soon on WICC. And right now on Newsline, a really important story from across the Long Island Sound that's, well, resonating really across the nation. Imagine that this happened to your elderly parent. Residents of a senior living community in Port Washington, Long Island, right now are absolutely pleading with New York State to save their homes and their life savings. Joining us live on Newsline is Dan Schreiber, the son-in-law of residents Richard and Barbara Newman. He's been advocating for them and with us now. Dan, so good to have you here. This is really something. Thanks so much for being here.
Oh, thanks, Bridget. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, so we're talking about the Harborside. It used to be called the Amsterdam. And basically, the folks who live there invested their life savings to live there. Tell us a little bit more about when the Newmans moved in there and, you know, how they had to invest their life savings in this.
Yes, Bridget. So my in-laws moved in approximately 2.5 years ago. And you are correct. They, like many of the other residents, they sold their home and they took the majority of their life savings and basically put their trust into this, what they call a CCRC, which is a continuing care retirement community. And this is a place that they decided to basically live the rest of their lives. They call these retirement communities a place where you can age in place. And the beauty about these CCRCs is that as their health changes throughout their life, they can transition between different levels of care without ever having to move. So, yes, they did invest, and this was their final stop in life, Bridget.
Right. And in their case, this being a continued care facility wound up being critical, right? As far as I understand it, Richard Newman had some health issues and had to move to a different part of the facility. But because they're both basically on the same campus, they're still able to be together.
That's right. That's right. The beauty of a CCRC, Bridget, is that they never have to leave. So whether they're in independent living or whether they need more assistance, they move to assisted living or skilled nursing, where my father-in-law at this point needs some memory care, has some memory care issues. So, yes, my mother-in-law visits him every single day. She walks down the hall. They're able to have, share good times together, but she's there and he knows she's there. So it's really a contained home that they don't want to give up.
Right.
And they're not alone, Bridget, because I've met through town hall meetings, I've met a number of these different residents, and a lot of them are in that situation where one partner is an independent, one partner is in memory care, and it's tough.
Yeah, it sure is. So let's talk a little bit about the finances here, and correct me if I don't have any of the details 100% here, but I understand the company had been in bankruptcy, that there was a purchase on the table. Someone else was supposed to come in and buy the facility. That wound up being nixed by the New York State Health Department. So what happens now?
So exactly. So when my mother-in-law called me several months ago and told me there was a group called LCS that was coming in to operate the facility and buy the facility and put a lot of renovations in the facility, I was extremely happy because this is a very, very financially astute group. They're the third largest nursing home care company in the country. They have over 130 nursing care facilities that they operate, 40,000 residents, and the owners of this company happen to be the owners of an NFL football team. So finances are not an issue. And what happened was, as you mentioned, this home has had some financial troubles and challenges in the past, and they have gone through bankruptcy. And the bankruptcy judge, Judge Alan Trust is his name, basically appointed LCS as the group that would come take over. So you have support from the bankruptcy judge. You have support from all the residents. Bridget, you have support from the staff. So this was a group that was ready to go. And as you said, in the early part of October, the regulatory hurdle that they had to get over, something happened, and the Department of Health said your application is not going through. So what we're asking for, and on top of that, LCS came in and said, listen, we're going to guarantee the life savings of all these residents and the prior residents, Bridget, to the tune of $130 million. So the life savings, how these CCRCs work is, when these families do pass, a percentage goes back to their relatives. That's how they work. So we had a phenomenal group, and now we're at this impasse. And what I'm hoping that can happen here is that the governor, and it's really come down to this, Bridget, that Governor Hochul can save the day here. And we're talking to some of her advisors and hoping that the governor will step in and bring the parties together. She has the power to do it. And as you've read and have seen, she doesn't want these people on the street. She wants to help. So that is our hope here, and it's the best path that Governor Hochul will bring these groups in a room, the Department of Health, LCS, and say, listen, you have our support. You have my support as the governor. You have our staff support. Let's get this deal done and save the home for these people. Save their life savings, save their home, save their lifetime health care. It's the easiest route, Bridget.
Right. In a nutshell, Dan, what was the New York State Health Department's problem with this?
Well,
it sounds like a great company with them coming in.
Right. So, you know, listen, there's always three sides of a story, Bridget. There's the Department of Health, there's LCS, and maybe it lies somewhere in the middle. So, you know, what I have gathered is the Department of Health, their issue is maybe some of the application wasn't filled out properly. I know there were some allegations in newspapers that they violated state laws, but that never happened. LCS is too big of a company. They would never, ever do that. And so the application wasn't properly filled out, or they omitted things. On the other side, LCS is stating that, hey, we complied with everything. Everything that was asked to us, we complied. So there's this in-between. And whenever it's a he said, she said scenario, Bridget. So how do you resolve that? The governor needs to step in.
Yeah, yeah.
So Governor Hochul steps in, just puts the parties in the room for 48 hours and says, you know, get this done. And no one's looking to do anything except from, you know, above board. And the governor knows that. But I don't think the governor's been told, you know, both sides of the scenario.
Mm-hmm.
Look, Department of Health is an agency under you know, her administration. But I'd just love to have them sit in a room. The governor says, take care of this. Because, look, this thing is – the temperature's rising here. Nobody wants the temperature rising. These people don't want to be told, hey, we can take you to a different home. You know, we can find you home. They want to stay where they are, Bridget, in Port Washington.
Of course, right. And in their particular case, it's where they raise their family. They want to stay. Well, Dan Schreiber, I'm so glad that you were able to come on our show. And again, you know, we do have listeners across the sound, but again, it's just a story that resonates with so many people. It's tough enough to have to, you know, encourage your elderly parent to move to a facility, and then something like this happens. Please do keep us updated, and we thank you so very much for your time.
Thank you, Bridget. I appreciate you listening. Thank you.
Our next guest is Ed Katz, and yeah, he's going to be talking about the movies.
From what's new in theaters to what you should be streaming, Ed Katz brings you the weekend movie preview now on Newsline with Bridget Quinn, WICC 600 and 95.9. The voice of Connecticut.
That's a big Hollywood intro for you there, Ed Katz. Good to have you with us again.
Thank you very much. I love that intro. That was great.
It's very Hollywood, isn't it? I love it. I love it.
It is, yeah.
We have a few things to talk about, but let's start with this classic movie from 1999. I'm going to play a clip. Listen carefully.
I see dead people.
In your dreams? While you're awake? Dead people, like, in graves and coffins?
Walking around like regular people.
Just hearing that, Ed, gives me the chills. Now, I wanted to watch it again last night. I didn't get a chance. But I should say, before we get our conversation going about this amazing movie, we're going to talk about the spoiler, right? So if you have not seen this movie, there is a twist, and we're going to spoil it. So turn your radio down and then come back for the other segments that we're going to tackle. What is so terrifying about this movie, Ed? I know what it was for me.
Oh, wow. It's just, you know, I think M. Night Shyamalan did a phenomenal job building the suspense. He works with the music people regularly, and that they just did a great job of adding to it. But Haley Joel Osment, his, and you heard his voice, he actually read the entire script 3 times the night before his audition, and he nailed the part, and M. Night Shyamalan had to give him the part. But I think he helps make it so visceral because you feel for him because he seems so genuine. And
right.
I earned him an nomination, very deservedly so.
Yeah, you can hear it in his voice just in that clip. He was amazing. I actually happened to be listening to a podcast about the making of that movie. And I don't know if this is true, but Michael Cera, I guess, went out for the role, said that he knew he wasn't good at all. But yeah, Haley Joel was amazing. And I guess he worked pretty closely with his dad as a young actor. And man, whatever he did, it was just, for me, what was so chilling about it was to think that a little boy would have that burden on him, this ability mm-hmm. to see beyond, to see the dead.
Right. That's his sixth sense. Exactly. And what was amazing for him was Spielberg, because of how great Osment did in this role, cast him as his robot boy, David, in the movie AI, Artificial Intelligence.
Oh, I didn't remember that. Wow, yeah.
Very, very powerful movie Spielberg made, controversial to an extent, but it's way ahead of the AI we have now. I mean, yeah. Way prescient for what we've been going through now. But can the construct of having a robot who with human emotion?
Yeah,
fascinating.
You mentioned he got an Oscar nod, and I guess 6 in all. I read, and the movie made mm-hmm. a ton of money at the box office too,
right.
But not to be overlooked. And it was also looking at the clips of it and getting the sound this morning. It was kind of poignant to look at Bruce Willis when he was, young and really in the prime of his career, obviously dealing with some, terrible health issues right now. Now, correct me if I'm wrong. I also heard that he kind of owed a movie to the studio. And that's why he wound up being attached to it. But I mean, he was great too.
Yes, absolutely, he was. And it was kind of against type for him because he had been, Die Hard. But he was going back and forth. I mean, Die Hard kind of set a new path for him because he was with Sybil Shepherd in Moonlighting.
Oh yeah.
And initially, he wasn't looked at as an action hero. So Die Hard broke the mold on that. And I remember the studio didn't even want to promote his name because when they showed it to test audiences, and his name came on the screen for Die Hard, the audiences started to laugh. And the executives were like, oh, we can't put his name up on there. And then after, of course, it got great reviews. He got great reviews and they put the name back on as they promoted the movie further. But he was able to go a couple different directions with his career. So it really
yeah.
helped him.
Yeah, from why the wisecracking detective, right, to the yeah. action hero, then to this, very sort of grave and like a quiet demeanor
right.
to the character of Malcolm, who there are some clues in the movie, right? If you rewatch it after you know the twist, there are some clues,
yeah.
right? Did you when you first saw it, did you see it coming?
So I have to say, and I led a discussion on this movie the other night, and I asked, there were about 20 people here, and I asked them who saw it coming. One person did the first time she saw it, she figured it out, but she said she hadn't seen it in a while because she knew we were doing the discussion. She watched it again, and she said she forgot and didn't catch it the second time she saw it.
Really?
So I thought that was really funny. And I remember there was a great scene where he talks about seeing dead people, and then they have the camera close up. I don't want to give it away too much, but they have the camera close up on one of the main characters, and the M. Night Shyamalan said, "Oh, we have to change it. It's too much of a giveaway." And they said, "Let's test it with audiences," and the audiences didn't pick up on it, so he was convinced to let it stay.
Huh.
And when you watch it the second time, you're like, "Oh, of course, how did I miss it?"
Yeah. I also heard that there were some clues with Malcolm's character wearing a wedding ring or
yeah.
not. But I think at the time, M. Night Shyamalan was he was not well known, right? I mean, that's
it
might have been a leap for Bruce Willis to sign on to a movie with this relatively unknown director-writer.
It was also a leap for the head of the Disney studio, who opted it without getting permission. He put $3 million to get the rights, and it came with the attachment that M. Night Shyamalan was going to be able to direct it himself. And it got the studio executive basically, it seemed to be a contributing factor in getting him dismissed, but he ended up doing fine. And of course, the movie was huge, $700 million worldwide on a $40 million budget. But, and I wanted to say, before I forget,
yeah,
it's actually, if you don't, it's on Max and Hulu, but if you don't have that, it's on HBO tonight at 7:10 p.m.
Oh, my guys will never let me not watch the World Series, but I mean, I'm going to have to go in another room.
But you can record it. And then the other show that's on tonight, the other movie that's terrific, is All the President's Men at 8 o'clock on TCM.
Oh, wow. Oh, my goodness.
Phenomenal movie and very timely, of course.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Oh, my gosh. I don't know if there's any one other thing to say about The Sixth Sense. Not to forget Toni Collette, who really, you know, just such an empathetic portrait of a mom who's just like doesn't really understand what's going on with her little boy. And, you know, what a spot to be in.
Right. And she was nominated for Best Supporting Actress for her role. And I thought she doesn't have a lot of screen time, but she did a great job with what she had. Yeah.
Yeah. Okay.
I give this movie 4.5 stars out of 5. It was
terrific. Wow.
Really, really well done. Seeing it the second time didn't ruin it for me. I appreciated how well it was made because it's way beyond just the gimmick. There's so much more to it.
Yeah. Yeah, there really is. I think after 25 years, I probably will be like watching it again for me, but I will remember the spoiler. And we are back with our voice of all things entertainment, Ed Katz joining us, katzreviews.com. Was there another website or anything else that you wanted me to mention, Ed? I forget.
Sure. Well, it's Catnip Marketing, cat with a K. And I actually just won a best PR campaign for a small business award. So I'm very excited about that.
Hey,
just literally an hour ago. So I'm very excited.
This just in, and congratulations. next, we're going to talk about a new series with Clive Owens. It's called Monsieur Spade. Let's play a quick clip of that one.
The old Jerry Noir has come home. You might want to protect yourself with something more reliable than just your wits.
These army intelligence, they want the boy.
You're just an American private copper, which in France gives you about the same legal authority as a rat catcher.
In my case, the two jobs are one and the same.
Yeah. Okay. There you go. All right. Monsieur Spade. That would be Sam Spade, the icon of detective fiction. Tell us about formerly played by Bogey, right?
Humphrey Bogart and the Maltese Falcon, one of the classics of all time, right? So this is set about 20 or so years later, almost. Sam Spade's retired. He's in a small town in South France trying to get away from everything. And, of course, you know, trouble seems to follow him. So that's what it's about. It's only 6 episodes. There's really no major names in the cast other than Clive Owen, but he does a very good job, and it's a nice, you know, mini series, just 6 episodes. It's not a huge commitment of time, but he, if you're not too familiar with him, Children of Men, Inside Man, and Croupier, which may be his breakout role, were what kind of launched him. But he does a good job, and it's a very engaging, lots of plot twists, a couple you might see coming and a couple I definitely did not. So that was, it was very enjoyable. And I give this a good 3.5 stars out of 5. It was fun, entertaining. It's not perfect. It has a couple of meandering moments, but it's pretty tight story for 6 episodes. It works pretty well.
Where is it streaming?
That is on Netflix exclusively.
On Netflix. Okay. All right. And speaking of Netflix, that would make sense. This was, what was I reading? The co-creator of Queen's Gambit did this one?
I think he had a role as one of the executive producers, if I remember.
Okay, yeah. The chess series. Yeah, that was a really, really good one. And I wonder what you think about this, Ed. When I saw this, I said, oh, okay, another like detective reboot, if you will. We've got, these days we have Kathy Bates as Matlock. We have that redo of Perry Mason with Matthew Reese, right? It seems like there's a lot to be mined there.
Yeah, bringing back the kind of classic famous detectives, you've got a known quantity. There's some, I guess you'd say, social equity already built in when you do that. So there's some familiarity with the characters, and you know, they've already been a proven success. If you can redo it and give it a fresh, you know, pickup, you've already got potentially a good built-in audience. So if it's done well, great. And this one was done well. I give it credit.
Okay, and you gave it a good rating too. All right. Mm-hmm. The next one we're going to talk about is something called Woman of the Hour, and here's a little sneak peek at that one.
Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to Woman of the Hour.
Let the games begin.
Bachelor number one. This is nice and easy. What are girls for?
What do you mean?
Just what I said. I believe in you, Bachelor number one.
That's good.
All right. This premise takes a little bit of explaining, but what we heard was Anna Kendrick, and she's a contestant trying to decide among the bachelors on the dating game. I'm old enough to remember the dating game. So explain mm-hmm. further, if you would, the premise.
Sure. So this is based on a true story that happened in the late 70s on the dating game. Anna Kendrick plays one of the contestants. And the bachelor she picks out of the three she was given a choice of is a serial killer in real life.
Oh, boy.
Right. And actually, when you see it, based on what, you know, she obviously couldn't see, she could only ask the questions and hear their answers, you can't blame her for choosing who she chose. But he answered the questions well, but that doesn't mean he's not a serial killer. So, it's Anna Kendrick's, she's not only in it, it's her directorial debut. And I understand how that works. Netflix is saying, okay, Anna Kendrick's got a name. And she's like, well, yeah, I'll do it, but you got to let me direct it. And I'm sure there may have been some hesitancy, but I have to tell you, it starts out kind of like a Lifetime movie. And mm-hmm. I'm like, okay, it's not going to be great, you know. But she builds in some nice little touches to it, directorial touches. And then the last half hour is riveting and extremely well done. And I give Woman of the Hour 4 stars out of 5.
Wow. Okay. And is this, I don't know if you said Netflix too, or yeah.
Netflix exclusive, right? Yeah. And now Daniel Zavato plays.
Yeah, I was going to ask you about him. Yeah, yeah. Tell me about him.
It's no secret. You know right off the beginning that he is a serial killer. And he's been in smaller roles in other movies. But Russell Crowe, he was shooting a film with Russell Crowe and told Russell Crowe, you know, here, I got this opportunity. And he listens to him and he says, you have to do this. Huh. You have to be the serial killer. This will be great for you. And he's like, really? Okay, well, I'll go talk to him. So he did. He ended up getting it. And he gives a lot of credit to Russell Crowe. And he's creepy. I mean, because he can be so nice, and then all of a sudden there's a very big turn, and he's not at all anymore. And Anna Kendrick recognizes it, and it, you know, almost too late, but it's very suspenseful. So she really came to prominence when she was nominated for Best Supporting Actress for Up in the Air with George Clooney. If you remember that.
Oh,
film.
I do remember that. She was really good in that. That was a good one.
That was really her breakout role, and she deserved her nomination. She to me was the character who really made that movie. And then she was in Pitch Perfect, the TV series, for a while, and she had a small role in Scott Pilgrim versus the World that kind of helped get her on the radar, which was a fun movie. Speaking of Michael Cera, by the way.
Right. Well, good for her for saying, I want to direct this, you know, like, yeah.
Well, and even better for doing a really good job, especially making that last half hour where it could have fallen apart. She really did a terrific job keeping it together and making it even more suspenseful.
Yeah. Do they, you know, it is about a serial killer at the end of the day. Do they delve? I mean, is it, you know, gory, grisly at all? Do they delve into the various murders?
Only a couple of them. And they kind of sum up what happened and how he ended up at the end. But it's a fascinating story of the justice system and the problems with it going way back to in the 70s, because there were alerts about this guy, and the police, frankly, just didn't do their job. And there's a woman who was trying to tell the police about it, and they kind of put her off, and she screams at them, just do your bleeping job.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And I think that was part of the point of the movie, is that, you know, we've got signs, people are pointing to this person, and he wasn't caught for a long time. And even after he got out on parole and committed two more crimes before he was tried. It's a horrendous story.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. And on a lighter note, a lesson learned, if Russell Crowe gives you some career advice, take it. Ed Katz, always great. I look forward to our Friday conversations. Ed Katz with KatzReviews.com. You have a fantastic weekend.
Thank you. You too.
All right. See you next Friday.